Hello and welcome to the First Take Film Club. I'm your host, Connor Norcott, and today, as always, I'm joined by these two wonderful fellas, Liam Jones and Luke Chandley. Boys, how you doing?
Yeah, good. Very well. Happy Mother's Day to all the mothers out there. It's been a weird week, hasn't it? Punctuated by what should have been quite a good week for people, starting with, International Women's Day and now Mother's Day. And bit of a strange one, but I suppose, yeah, I'm all right personally, just yeah, plodding along. How about you guys?
Yeah, I am great. Other than the fact that, yeah, just why not add on to what Luke said, the country's fucked slightly. But you know, this is a film show, not a political show. We'll leave that for the other guys to do. But yeah, I'm a little bit tired actually. I don't have a bed. So mum and dad took my bed apart yesterday and put it in the bin pretty much, and the mattress too. Mm-hmm. So I was like, well, first of all, I thought, why didn't we just do that like the day of the new bed coming? Because I've got a new bed coming in a few days. Why didn't they just do it then? So now I tried to sleep downstairs. I tried to sleep downstairs on the sofa so I could have a telly. And instead, I just ended up staying up and watching Whiplash that was on BBC Two last night, and then realizing that I can't get comfy on a sofa. So then I had to go and sleep in the bunk bed, and it's just too small. It's a bunk bed is too small for me when I've been sleeping in a double bed for so long. So yeah, that's my predicament, and that's kind of where I'm at this morning. A little bit tired, a little bit frustrated. How are you, Connor?
I've got to be honest, I'm kind of jealous. The whole idea of a bunk bed kind of makes me think that might be kind of fun. But I know logistically it's a bit of a fucking mess, but as soon as you said bunk bed, my eyes went, oh, that might be interesting. Yeah, I'm all right. I feel like I've had a bit of a rough uni week and just I've done all the work in the world. But as I was saying before we started recording, light, I can see the light at the end of the tunnel. We're almost there. I'm almost there. I've got one more day and I've got to kind of do a presentation on Monday, which makes me a little bit sweaty and nervous, but it'll be all right. But then I'm going to go do a talk with Shane Meadows afterwards, and honestly, if that's like the cherry on top of a cake, a misery cake, which is kind of apt to Shane Meadows because most of the films are quite miserable, I think I'll be all right.
That's so, really good.
Yeah honestly, it's the thing I'm looking forward to. I keep thinking, like, as soon as the presentation's over, which I'm probably going to be last because I always kind of bitch out, hope everyone leaves the Zoom call, so I'm only doing it to like six people, I can just go and see Mr. Meadows and talk.
Is
about
that like is that quite a few people in the Zoom chat with Shane Meadows? Or
I think it's going to be quite a few. It's through uni, but I mean, I have a link for it. So if anyone wants to come, drop me a message and I'll send you the link. I don't know if I should say that. I might get cancelled or something. Who knows? Anyway, normally we start with an opening question, and because we did Fury Road this week, I've been so desperate to watch this film in the cinema because I never got the chance to. And I was wondering, with the cinemas, you know, we're really close to them opening up finally again, hopefully staying open as well. I want to know if you could go to the cinema later this evening or maybe tomorrow afternoon, whatever time period your favorite, and see one film of your choosing, what would you pick?
Oh, what would I pick? It's just such a good question. It's so hard, isn't it? I feel like it's a question where you think of it and then all the movies disappear from your mind. But let's say, I thought Drive, but I think that's because I've been wanting to watch it like quite recently anyway. So that would be quite cool. I could go to the cinema and watch that. And I really am avoiding saying the obvious, like, blockbuster films, like, let's say Jurassic Park, for example. But I'm gonna say Drive. Yeah, I'm going to say Drive.
For me, other than like when I was watching Whiplash last night, I was like, oh, I'd love to have seen this in the cinema. Like, but I've got to be honest, the first time I watched it was on like a really old laptop, and, you know, please don't arrest me. It was a dodgy link. Mm-hmm. I was a young boy.
Yeah, and you've grown now. You're matured now.
I've grown. I don't do that anymore. Anyway, yeah, and it literally blew my mind. So I don't think maybe being in the cinema would have affected it that much because I loved it so much either way. But I would have loved to like experience something like Terminator 2 or Aliens in the cinema for the first time with an audience who are all so excited, you know, for for what's going down. You know, something like that would have been so, so good. Just some of the most famous action films of all time. But like, I guess if I was to go and see a film tonight, like say I went to go see Aliens in the cinema tonight, well, it wouldn't be the same, would it?
Mm-hmm.
If you, you know, going to see it for the first time with that crowd, I think that would have been. And like another film that we've done before on the podcast, like the Rocky Horror Show.
Yeah, that would be fun.
Like going to see that, you know, it was famous for its late night showings in America, where it kind of grew in popularity. Going to one of those at night, that like a midnight showing of that would have been insane. Like all the booze and all the fun, like would have been had. So yeah, what about you, Connor?
You know, at the minute, I was talking about this presentation that I'm doing. I'm doing this thing on the Sundance Film Festival and kind of how it's become a bit more commodified, and especially with like the introduction of streaming services and stuff. But because I've been reading up about it, I've been hearing about like the films that debuted there, like Reservoir Dogs was kind of made in the Sundance Lab, and then it was debuted there. And the debut film screening was actually woeful. Like the projector broke halfway through and people started walking out. And I can just imagine Tarantino fuming at that. Also, there's films like Steven Soderbergh's Sex, Lies, and Videotape, all these little films that kind of blew up and became like 90s icons. So I think I'd want to see something that was like just about to come out or really close to coming out or something I've been really waiting for. And, you know, sign it off on the first take bingo sheet. I want to see the new Paul Thomas Anderson movie, man. Of that Bradley Cooper set in what, 70s LA? About a weird school. I think it's like a school, high school drama or something. I'm in. As long as he's not playing a high school kid, I'm into that. I'm well up for that.
I've got two things. Having a bit of time to think. The first one is Blair Witch Project. I just think that'd be sick in the cinema. Like, you know, like when it came out around like the actual time.
Yeah.
So if we could replicate that tonight, that'd be good. The other one is more of like a memory of what, like, it'd be cool to go back to that. And we spoke about this recently. So when we went to see Parasite and like the cinema was completely full, like if we could kind of do that, that would be a cool one to see again, because like, because it's what's the word? Subtitled. Like it being in the cinema just captures your attention completely because you can't do anything else. So you're like watching it, especially for me, who's like always on Twitter. They're my two additions.
Man, I always think about that Parasite screening, you know, and it was like the first time and the only time all three of us have watched a film together in the cinema.
Yeah.
And I always being a packed out fact, friends of the show fact. And it was like, I think we saw an early screening of it the day before it came out or something, maybe.
Yeah.
The day it came out. Really? Oh man, I loved that.
Song. I always think about Parasite, and I always think about when me and you went to go and see Uncut Gems.
Oh man, I watched it to calm down. That's how stressed I was during the week. I was like, you know what, I need to watch, because for some reason I was doing all this work and watching Adam Sandler and Kevin Garnett interviews in the background and just watch them. I was like, you know what, I need to put this film on to get out of my system. And that day was amazing.
I swear to God, I don't think you'll ever sit next to someone as vocal as Connor in that film. It was hilarious. It was just like genuinely him shouting out, "Oh my God!" Like in a very small cinema. Actually, we went to the Everyman in Liverpool. It was quite a small screen, but it was super fun. I loved it.
Still embarrasses me to this day. But you know what? At least I was into the film. So on to the movie then, and like I touched on earlier, we're covering Mad Max: Fury Road, which was directed by George Miller and came out in 2015. First, I'll give you like a little bit of information about the film. So if you're into this sort of thing, it had a budget of $150 million, which is actually fucking mental, but it makes sense when you see the film. And surprisingly enough, it did incredibly well. It doubled that at the worldwide box office. I think it took something like $360 million overall. It was nominated for 10 Academy Awards and it won 6. Including the likes of sound design, sound mixing, film editing, and all that jazz. The main cast, you got Max, played by Tom Hardy, Furiosa, by Charlize Theron, and Nux, played by Nicholas Holt, who's this kind of little war boy, zealot kind of guy. Guys, honestly, I'll give a quick little synopsis, but I really want to hear what you think about this. So, set in a post-apocalyptic wasteland, a woman rebels against the tyrannical warlords Immortan Joe, with the help of a group of female prisoners, an acolyte of Joe, and a drifter named Max. So Luke, this was your first take. and I want to know what you think.
I think it was good. I don't know whether, so just baseline first take, I don't know whether it was hyped so much that it was impossible for me to enjoy it as much as everyone who has seen it multiple times said it's boss. What I did, I really liked it. I think what really helps you get into it is the fact that like the whole world is just so immersive and like, you know, it's so unique, but also, I don't know, not relatable in terms of like the world, but like it's not so far removed that it's completely unbelievable, if that makes sense. So I did enjoy it a lot. I thought it was good and it's something that I'd watch again, but I just think it was impossible really for it to live up to, like, you know, because it's, let's just say, for example, when we introduced it in last week's pod, we were like, I think Liam said what one could be one of the best kind of action movies, especially modern action movies. So like, it's kind of like, for me, like, where'd you go from there? Because it's kind of the only way is down. But yeah, I enjoyed it and would definitely watch it again.
And onto yourself, Liam. Yeah, I just want to know quickly before I jump in and talk about all the technical stuff and cry about all how good that is. What did you think, Liam?
So I've seen it a few times now. I've got it on the background now, actually. And it is great. I think the first time I watched it, though, I don't think I enjoyed it that much. I don't know why. I don't know if I just didn't appreciate it or I wasn't watching it properly, wasn't paying attention. I'm not too sure. But then I revisited it a few years later. And honestly, it is just brilliant. It is brilliant. I think the action is amazing. I think technically as well, it might be one of the most technically impressive films that you'll ever see, like, period. I think as well, you know, yeah, George Miller's great, but I don't think he'll ever be as good as when he directed Happy Feet 1 and 2. So let's just... and Babe Pig in the City.
I was about to say, his best film is Babe Pig in the City. I'm kidding, obviously, but I love Babe Pig in the City.
His filmography is crazy. Yeah. It is crazy. I think it goes from, like, the last Mel Gibson Mad Max film to Babe Pig in the City. And then I think he might have, like, had a couple of... I don't know, must have directed a couple of dramas. Then it goes to Happy Feet 1 and 2 and then Mad Max Fury Road. Like, very, very strange. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, you know, I think that's it is weird, isn't it? How you can go from directing Happy Feet 1 and 2 and then direct one of the most interesting and technically impressive action films of all time. Very, very, but it's impressive. I think it's even more impressive. To me, it is anyway.
It's really weird, isn't it? I think, it came out in 2015 and we talked about the Oscars. We'll kind of touch on a little bit more of that later on because for some people it signifies whether a film was really good or not. But anyway, I remember having the choice to see this or to see The Revenant in cinemas at the time. I think they came out not that close together, but being where I'm from in Northern Ireland, there wasn't a lot of screenings constantly updated. So me and a couple of my mates, and I was like, I think I had already kind of seen it, maybe like a bootleg version of it. Sorry again, if anyone's listening and it's going to cancel me for that. So I was like, you know, we'll go and see The Revenant because, you know, it's in Iñárritu and it's Leonardo DiCaprio. He's going to win an Oscar. Tom Hardy's in this one too. Don't worry about it. And I remember really enjoying The Revenant the first time I saw it. And all my mates were like, what a fucking load of garbage that was. Why didn't we go and see Mad Max? And I was like, oh, I feel like I've let everyone down here. But since then, honestly, I think I was kind of similar to you, Liam, where on first watch, it didn't really do that much to me. It was kind of overwhelming and kind of exhausting because it is just, it's just action with kind of a really minimal, simple plot. And actually, yeah, you know what? I'm going to touch on that now. So in terms of plot, it is pretty straightforward. Most of the narrative revolves around Furiosa trying to escape and rescue these women who are being imprisoned and enslaved by this warlord, Immortan Joe. And it essentially boils down to just two chase scenes, one away to somewhere called the Green Place or whatever it was called, and then one back to the Citadel. On first watch, that completely, I was like, why are they going back on themselves? Obviously now it makes sense in terms of the narrative, but I kind of want to know What did you boys think about that? Because it does seem kind of, I guess on first watch, you could almost think it was kind of contrived and a bit nothing really.
I wonder whether that's one of the things that, like, on first watch, because obviously Liam mentioning that he was unsure, basically, and then I think maybe I'm just about 6 years behind Liam in terms of, like, you know, our first watches are quite similar. I don't know whether there's a couple of things, isn't there, and it's based around that plot, but also there's the dialogue isn't massive, which I knew about before coming into the film, I think, so that's not too bad. But yeah, the fact that the plot is essentially going somewhere, then coming back from somewhere from pretty early on, really. And that jarred a little bit, or felt a little bit like unsubstantial. And not as the movie goes on, like, it's, you know, because these are the punctuated with, like, these most extravagant, incredible action scene, genuinely, like, you know, I don't know if it was Liam who said earlier, or maybe we were off camera, but like some of, like, modern cinema's greatest kind of action scenes, definitely, I think. And that's, I don't think that's up for question, really. But yeah, I just found that, I did find the kind of, I don't know, quite straightforwardness of it, mate. I don't know, we're used to cinema, which is just like, this happens, and then there's a twist, and then we go back. It's kind of like, mm-hmm. The only twist was like, when Max was kind of going to go away, and then comes back, and it's quite straightforward, which is interesting. And I was into it, to be honest with you. Like, if I'd have gone into it being like, you know, it is what it is, very much like the plot kind of is what it is, maybe I would have felt a little bit better. And that's why I'm actually quite excited to go back, maybe in a couple of months. But yeah, weird at first sight, but it was, you know, I do think it was good. It was good.
I think another thing that maybe threw me the first time I watched it is that the film is called Mad Max, but
it's not really
about Max at all. It's about Furiosa. Yeah. And I don't know if how old I must have been, 17. Probably I just fully expected, like, this Tom Hardy action film and it to be about Tom Hardy, and then kind of just got threw off maybe a little bit by the kind of the storyline that goes kind of around him, almost through him, actually. Which then I realised kind of the next time round that, okay, yeah, he isn't central to the plot, but he is vital to the plot because he kind of does these little things that will shift things forward, and we keep getting these little glimpses into his past and maybe, you know, the little hints of trying to understand where he's at in his life now. And, you know, personally, I've never seen the original Mad Max films, so I'm not there on the character development of Mad Max. I'm not sure what type of person he is, or, you know, his characteristics or whatever. So my first impression of Mad Max is through Tom Hardy's performance. So I think that as well is another thing which it took me maybe like the second or third time I watched it to kind of maybe appreciate a bit more. But, you know, that being said, it's still, I think even despite the lack of dialogue, I think it's still, you know, they're still fantastic performances. Tom Hardy and Charlize Theron are exceptional. Charlize Theron in particular is exceptional. And all of the extras as well, it's crazy. All of the, what are they called? The halflings?
The war boys.
The war boys. Like, they're all ridiculous. Nicholas Holt is like the main one. We actually get some kind of in-depth kind of character-based stuff, looking at, you know, how he's affected. But it's all brilliant. It is all brilliant. And like with the War Boys as well, like they have all these interesting quirks, you know, they spray their teeth with, what is it, like chrome?
Chrome paint, I think.
For some reason, and scream like "Witness me" when they're about to like do like a like sacrifice themselves, which is that is kind of like a reflection on how is he's a dad, right? And Morton Joe is like the father of like everyone.
It's father in the deification way. You know what I mean? They treat him as almost this kind of, he's not just a warlord; he's a god. He's there. Yeah. They're all father or whatever. Kind of, it is kind of the Odin thing, and they always talk about being welcomed into Valhalla, like it's this mystical place that warriors go when they've accomplished what they should do in battle and stuff like that.
But he has all of these wives. He's obviously impregnated. So to me, the impression I had was they're all his. Like you think of someone like Genghis Khan, who had how many children? I think it was some, like ridiculous like between 500 and 1,000 kids at least. You know, maybe I'm wrong, but I'm sure it's something like that. And I think maybe it was kind of maybe George Miller's trying to play on that a little bit, that trope of like this tyrannical figure who just thinks he has the right to do something like this.
There's something in that, because I think quite a lot of the details are about exploitation and about the exploitation of women, resources, men, everyone that's below him is exploited. And everyone's value is based on what they can offer to people in power. And I find that really interesting. And it's once again, sci-fi, if you want to call it, maybe post-apocalyptic kind of settings. They always do kind of conjure up these feelings that are kind of already pervading in modern society, if you want to have it that way. I do, quickly before we get onto that, because there's a lot of like, I think there is quite a lot of nuance that we can talk about. It isn't really picked up on first watch, so it might be interesting to hear, Luke, how you thought about some of this as well. But yeah, firstly, I want to talk about visually, because I feel like that's the most, on first watch, especially for you, Luke, it was the most engaging part of the film, is that it is fucking stunning, for want of a better term. What did you think about that?
Yeah, that's the first thing you pick up on, which is probably, you know, as we were talking about just then, like the plot and all the different parts of the plot and the characters, is probably slightly to the detriment of a first watch, maybe. Because, it's sad that could be the case, because it is so, like, absolutely incredible that you can, like, in the best way possible, you can't take your eyes off it. Because, like, I suppose if you're, maybe not for... you know, the general movie go, I was just going for the film, but I think the way maybe that we think about films, just in like a overall point, that from like plot to visual to technical, just, you know, the things that go through my mind are kind of the length of time it must have taken to produce these scenes, and hard work that's gone on behind the scenes and with teams that just aren't on camera, and how painstaking that must have been. But like, the payoff was so amazing. I think so that's what made, you know, that, and that's, I think that's a lot, made up a lot of my first take, which is probably, I imagine if you would have, you'd ask probably 100 people, many of them would kind of say like, great film, looked absolutely like incredible and immersive. And especially when you've got like an era really, which is, and it's really interesting. I was just looking, when we were talking before, I was looking at George Miller's kind of back catalogue, which, sidebar, is absolutely bananas, the way it goes through Mad Max movies into like family friendly and then back to Mad Max again. But when we now, like, we're in an era where like world building is the norm, you know, you take every, you know, from Harry Potter to Marvel to, you know, even Universal with the failed Universal Monsters series. Well, actually, they could really do have taken a look at this film, really, because, okay, it was made by the original director and writer of the first, I think it was a trilogy, wasn't it? But it looks like they've gone into this film kind of being like, we don't want to, you know, yeah, we're making a sequel, but we don't want to make, you know, we're not just making a sequel, we're going into this world and we're living in it, and we're trying to create something that stands out, and they just properly do that, and it's, you know, just even everything from like the kind of the gear stick to like in the cars to like the, you know, the vehicles and how they are slightly different from each other but largely the same, and just absolutely everything is just phenomenal.
The thing that I appreciate more and more each time I watch it is just the sheer amount of detail. And normally, you like visually, you do see those stuff you talked about. Like every individual person has their own vehicle, or you know, maybe little squads of people have their own vehicle, and it is completely modded and decked out with all these kind of relics. And I think it comes down, quite a lot of it comes down to how this film was kind of brought about and brought to life, where initially there was no scripts; everything was just storyboards. The whole thing was something like 13,000 storyboards, and in fact, I think George Miller got, I think his name is Brendan McCarthy, he's a storyboard artist, to come in, and he ended up getting a writing credit for the film. That's how detailed the story, like, because in terms of everything you're saying, it's so much easier to understand the world of the film visually rather than reading it. There's a great breakdown on YouTube I watched this morning about how the film is written. And basically, if you tried to write out the scenes, the storyboards that you see in front of you, it would be like 500,000 pages long. And there's no way that script would ever get made or that film would ever get made. And I think one of the things I noticed as well is the immersion is what kind of, you might find certain scenes interesting, but the immersion is what keeps you in the zone. And whether it is the cars or the characters or even like the little bits of character development, which I want to talk about later. But the thing that jumped out to me this time was the stuff it won Oscars for, was the sound editing, was the mixing, was the everything works. And it's almost tangible. It's almost like you can almost hear the fucking gears churning in your head once the film's over. And I wrote in the agenda, you can almost smell the oil. Like, it is so, I keep saying immersive and I feel like I need a bit bigger vocabulary or whatever, but it is so immersive. It is so captivating. And I want to know for you, Liam, because I think you have seen this a couple of times. How did you feel the immersion played out for yourself this time around?
It did. I think a massive part of that is the editing, mm-hmm. and with like the, yes, I did Google this, but the techniques they used, which is eye trace and crosshair framing to mm-hmm. keep everything in the center of the screen. So it is, you are immersed constantly because you can't really look away. Mm-hmm. You know, everything is right there in the center of the screen. So that in itself is a little bit genius in that, you know, I would think it was a difficult thing to do. I mean, I'm not a filmmaker, so I don't know. But, you know, to actually go above and beyond to make sure that, you know, this is, you know, for 2 hours, every single bit of important action is central to the screen. Mm-hmm. And kind of everything else is just almost, I wouldn't say filler, it's kind of the incredible backgrounds that they've kind of shot in and the... Did they shoot in the Australian outback? Is that where they filmed this?
They shot it all in Namibia, I think, in Africa. I think they shot it all there. But it's meant to resemble the outback, isn't it?
It is, isn't it? Yeah. But yeah, because
but there's one quick thing I wanted to actually just jump in on here. We're all fans of Edgar Wright, and we all at one point or another time used to listen to Empire or read Empire. There was a great interview Edgar Wright did about this film. And why it was, for his money, the best action film ever made. Whether you agree or not, it's fine. And it was all to do with the center framing and how... The reason it's so good is because on first watch, you get the whole narrative. Even if you don't kind of follow the detail around it, you get why people are going from A to B and B to A again. And everything on second watch, you kind of look outside the frame if you want. And there's so much detail happening there that like you just talked about, Liam, it is so... It just grabs you. And while you're watching it, you're kind of almost subliminally, because your eye doesn't just focus on what's in front of you. It kind of takes in and decodes what's on screen. And George Miller had this great thing where he said there was, I can't remember how it's like speed downloading information. People nowadays, movie consumers, he called them, which kind of sat uncomfortably with me. They download information so quickly that they want action scenes to play out hyper quick. You think of films like John Wick, or you think of films like The Raid, where everything happens quite authentically, and that's all good. But then you look at films like, I was going to use Six Underground, where there's 50 million cuts a second, the Michael Bay film on Netflix. And that, oh yeah, fast paced, that's great. George Miller does that too, but all the action happens all over the shop. And there's no weight to the camera, and there's no movement that actually means anything.
Is that why either he or the editor decided to do this thing where like everything is sped up in a strange way? You know how like everyone seems to move in like a, you know how mm-hmm. in zombie films where they do it?
Yeah.
I don't know what technique it is, but I remember thinking, oh, they just do it sometimes. But then when I rewatched it the other day, I was like, no, it's pretty much throughout the whole film that this weird technique is used. I don't know, Connor, if you can explain what that is, because I don't know what the hell it's called.
The only simple thing I know it as is they either filmed it in a higher frame rate where the action happens quicker. Normally films shot in 24, 25, 26 frames per second. They must have filmed it in maybe 30 or something. Or they either just sped it all the fuck up, which I kind of think they just sped it up, because there's a scene right at the start where Tom Hardy jumps from 5 meters away on top of a car, like over a car. And I was like, he's either got an incredible jump or they've sped that up really quickly.
I'm so glad that you said that, Liam, because I actually completely forgot about that. And I think it was one of those things where, like, yeah, when you go into the film, you notice that straight away because it's unusual. And then as it goes on, you actually just forget about it because you're immersed in it. But I just love how much of a frenzy that it creates for the film. And, like, you know, you're going into this world which is kind of unusual, and it's, you know, they're creating this, I don't know, this kind of universe where everything's a bit mad, and, like, you know, even like the sets and the props and everything. So there's literally this world is all a bit a caricature of something or other. But the thing that really sews it together is the fact that, like, it feels more mad because the way it's shot, it's just in an absolute frenzy. And it's really, like, it's fucking boss. I absolutely love it. And I completely forgot about it because, you know, as I said earlier, you watch the film and for the first 15 minutes you're kind of figuring everything out, or, like, trying to get a grasp, I suppose, of what's going on and where you are and what's happening and, oh, why is that doing that? And then as it goes on, it just becomes normal because you're fully immersed in this world. And I just love that happens. And I just think it creates a proper frenzy, and I think it works really well.
I feel like maybe it was almost a decision that they had to make, that it was something they had to do as well, because I read that the cars could only, when they were actually filming real time, the cars could only ever go 25 to 30 miles per hour. So you have to do something, right, to make it look like they're going as fast as possible. You know, obviously you can do stuff with, like, moving the camera back while the car goes forward to make it seem it's going faster, but, you know, there are plenty of shots where that isn't happening with the camera, so you have to do something to make it seem like it's going fast, because, you know, there's a lot of, like, car chasing, so they're obviously going to be going fast. So I don't know if maybe that was something they decided on, you know, we need to do something to make sure the cars look fast all the time. And that's something that is quite interesting to me. I was saying to Luke off air before you joined, Connor, that I was reading an IndieWire piece with the editor of the film. I think it's the editor is George Miller's wife, which I can't remember her name. Wow. I'm so sorry. And she was saying about the absolute hours and hours of footage. I think just for the final sequence alone, she had to sift through 100 hours of footage. She speaks about some of the techniques that we've already spoken about. She spoke about it quite interestingly in terms of the action in the film when they tested it with audiences. At first, there was so much action in it that people just didn't like it. It was too much. And she had to almost kind of refine it and almost bring it down a notch to a bit more of a human level. So then she started to just sift through everything with Max and Furiosa, either separately or together, so that they can almost make it more personal, I guess. And then I think, like, once she did that, but she was speaking, the way she was speaking, man, it seemed like she had one hell of a job on her hands.
Yeah, apparently, I think it took 2 years. So was it 2 years to edit that film together?
Yeah.
I like that you touched on that they kind of made the two lead characters the kind of focus of the film, and the whole narrative kind of does drive through them, and the tangents of each kind of sub-story are all brought back to them. They're kind of at the center of everything. Because we talked about earlier that it's a Mad Max film when he's not the main character. It's Furiosa's movie, essentially. What did you think of the performances, first of all, Luke? Because there's a thing I find really interesting that I put in the agenda somewhere in the mad scribbles that are in there that I'll talk about later on, but I want to know what you guys thought first.
Yeah, I think that is another thing, isn't it, that kind of throws you slightly off-centre, is the fact that, like, it's called Mad Max, and actually It's a bit of like a passing of the torch thing almost, maybe, for, I don't know whether there'll be future films, or maybe we'll touch on that in a minute. But it's actually not, especially the storyline, especially is about Furiosa and Max is kind of there for the ride, or he's at the beginning to introduce you into this world again, or worlds in general. But I think, how do you say her name? Charlize Theron. She's I think she's bossing, like, in many things that she's in. She's just absolutely class. And in this, I don't know, maybe cause it's not usually what I've seen her in, but then I suppose it's also not what I've usually seen Tom Hardy in, because I don't usually see films like this. But she's absolutely amazing, and, like, kind of the character is actually, considering in this mad world, which is believable and unbelievable, she makes it pretty human, really. Mm-hmm. Considering there's actually not that much dialogue, you don't see her captive for very long at the beginning. Mm-hmm. Although you obviously get to understand that she is, and that's probably with obviously different aspects. One being breaking out the other women from that area and trying to free them, and she just does that so well without having actually that much to work with vocally, I suppose. And Tom Hardy, I'm not a massive Tom Hardy fan, or I didn't think it was. I was talking about this to one of my mates, Ali, in our group chat, and I was kind of saying, like, meh, I could take or leave him. And then I actually remember just thinking, oh, actually, Bronson's absolutely amazing. And,
yeah, man.
Oh, he's pretty good in Mad Max, and I've heard he's good in Locke. And then you go, like, well, actually, and I really like him as Bane. And then actually, you think, yeah, he's good, isn't he? And he's the same in this. Like, he's, again, just not quite as central as maybe Furiosa, but he does a lot with his character with not a lot to say.
I loved you brought up Bronson there, because I feel like after you've seen Bronson, you completely understand what Tom Hardy's doing here. He is quite a physical actor, and he is all a kind of about body language and how he holds himself. And in this film, I know he plays a drifter named Max, is what it is in the IMDb bio, which I kind of stole earlier. Everything is, he's almost animalistic. Like, there's the scene where he, you know, him and Furiosa begin their fight when they first meet each other, and the wives are there trying to pull him off. He's got a chain around his face, almost like a dog, and they're trying to pull him off like he's a fucking pit bull or something. I really, really love that, because you kind of do see, I'm going to be nice here to the film, I think you do see an evolution of character somewhat. I don't think he changes that much, but he becomes a bit more open, and he kind of relaxes in front of her, and she is the kind of stoic leader of this freedom fight, essentially. She is the one that everyone's rallying behind. And I don't know if anyone else could have done that apart from Charlize Theron. I think she's awesome. What did you think, Liam?
I'll throw it to Luke, because you seem like you want to say something. Go on.
Has he put his hand up?
Yeah, that's what we started doing now, to try and cut out talking over each other. Sorry, Liam. I don't want to forget what I really like about this film in terms of the casting. And I haven't seen the early Mad Maxes, so there may be like a particular actual reason that this has happened. But I'm so happy that they didn't get Mel Gibson back. Because, like, in terms of, like, let's just take, for example, and the trilogy that came back with another film a few years later, Indiana Jones, I think they really could have, like, developed the Crystal Skull film, apart from the fact that it's largely pretty garbage. If you just kind of commit to, it's fine, we'll just have this other actor, and, you know, it doesn't necessarily need to be explained. And, like, physically, obviously, the two men, Tom Hardy and Mel Gibson, are completely different, even in, if you go back to the era of Mad Max, the original trilogy. Mm-hmm. But I'm just really happy that, like, it doesn't need acknowledging, because, like in James Bond, for example, you can have another iteration of a character and still understand that character's that character. And I'm really made up that they didn't do, like, oh, well, we'll get Mel Gibson back because everyone knows his face. And that's quite an artistic decision in general, quite a brave decision. But I'm just made up that they did do that, and they went with someone else who is even, like, physically quite different. But again, that doesn't matter really, because the audience aren't idiots, basically, is supposed the point there. But I just wanted to mention that before we moved on from the characters, yeah.
Yeah, I don't think you would have been able to do as much with Mad Max if it was Mel Gibson. Not to mention that, like, not many people like Mel Gibson anymore. He is a problematic person.
I'm glad you said it that way and not the way I would have said it. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
So, yeah, you would have already been losing, you know, a big chunk of audience by casting Mel Gibson. You know, it's he already loses. You know, he that there's a reason why he only really directs films now, because his appearance on screen makes people feel a little bit uncomfortable. Also, I've searched the name of the editor. It's Margaret Sixel, and she won an Oscar for this, so I feel like I really should have known. So yeah, I just wanted to give a name because I felt bad that I didn't know her name.
What a gem. Honestly, I the editing is the thing that really stuck out to me on this watch, apart from the character stuff, because quite a lot of the action is told, quite a lot of the narrative, sorry, is told through action and told through physical relationships and physical expression. It's almost like a silent film with the loudest soundtrack you've ever heard in your fucking life and the loudest, you know, sound design you've ever heard in your fucking life as well. And there's a one little moment I want to touch on that kind of sums up the two main characters in the film. I can't remember who it was I saw do this. This is not an original Connor Norcott analysis piece. As someone else did this, I just copied it. Essentially, the relationship boils between Max and Furiosa boils down to like weapons and how that's involved, where they first they start off trying to kill each other with each other's weapon, which already in itself kind of has overtones of they could be on the same side. They're almost using parts of each other to kind of fight each other. There's already a connection there. Then eventually, when they do start to team up, when he eventually does take the gun off her, which he is constantly aiming a gun at her for most of the opening hour, they end up kind of passing weapons back and forth, and they kind of do start to work together as a team. And there's a shot just before the bit I'm about to talk about where they both aim at the same person, and it's only like 6-7 frames or whatever. But I think that's really nice, and it's really simple. And you touched on earlier, look, the audience aren't idiots. You might not understand that that's what George Miller was doing intentionally, but, you know, subconsciously and semiotically, you're looking at it and you're kind of decoding film language, and you get it because you've watched X amount of films in your life. And then it all comes down to one of my favorite scenes is where I think it's the bullet farmer is coming after them and they're stuck in sand, and Tom Hardy or Max, sorry, kind of has to like pull the rig out with a tree. They kind of winches the tree around, and there's a scene where he's taking these sniper shots, trying to hit him in the dark, but he can't see anything. And he's got one bullet left, and eventually he gives the gun to Furiosa behind him, and she aims it on his shoulder. And they're kind of aligned in that one moment, and you're like, oh, okay, they're together now. They trust each other. They're a team. That's such simple but really good visual story making, but visual storytelling and visual filmmaking. And it's kind of why George Miller won an Oscar, or was nominated for an Oscar. And you know what? Probably should have won, because The Revenant, while it was a bit of a slog, it's kind of shit.
Yeah, I agree. I think as well, it's interesting with Tom Hardy and Charlize Theron. I think another director might have tried to make them their kind of friendship a thing of romance, that they would have like a kiss at the end, and it would be all like, oh, now they finally get each other. But no, instead, the most intimate moment they have is when Tom Hardy is trying to shoot with a sniper, and he can't quite get the aim right. So then he hands a sniper to her. Mm-hmm. She balances it on his shoulder and takes a shot and makes a shot. Like, that's the most intimate they get.
I agree. Like, I fully agree.
And like that in itself, though, it's like, it's not like in terms of the story and their kind of relationship, it is kind of important because it's them kind of working together finally. And, you know, she's using him to help herself to try and get the shot right. I think like that is clever filmmaking. Like, it's clever. It's clever storytelling. It's clever character work. And it also like is not conforming to kind of the stuff that we all see all the time in every film. We don't need to see that. We don't need to.
I also think that would have taken away from the kind of female emancipation that is going on in this film, where they are trying to break free of this rule and this kind of being completely enslaved. And by it, like you said, if another director were to do that and, you know, kind of make a gimmick out of their quote unquote love, it would have been a big stinker of a move in my book, and I wouldn't have enjoyed it.
100%.
I kind of talked about one of my favorite moments, which is that kind of when they're stuck in the sands. I was just wondering what moment stood out for you boys. Was there anything in particular? Because like I said, they're not really scenes in this film. There are just 17 minute long action sequences, which are all fucking awesome. But what took your interest the most?
I think heading into the sandstorm, that was pretty interesting. And again, that is probably visually, really. A lot of the movie is visual for me, to be honest. And the more we talk about it, even now, and we say this quite a lot, I think, especially on films that we start off from quite a low base in terms of like general enjoyment or maybe first time enjoyment, we always end up going, oh, that's a, yeah, God, I can't wait to watch that again. So that's how I do feel, and I can't wait to kind of get stuck into these things. But I think the sandstorm moment was just visually like kind of pretty gorgeous. But I also liked, I think it's the very beginning, and I think just because it gives you a clue of what film you kind of enter into, or even just gives you the gravity of Joe, the tyrant, when he with the scene where he's turning the water on and off.
I love that.
And almost like the currency is water, or the kind of that's what everyone's after, and they say like, oh, don't overdo yourself on water, because then you'll become reliant on it. And I think that's like a good general message itself, you know, for about many things. But I just think that kind of gives you the gravity of like, oh, well, this is why these people are trying to escape, and this is what this person's doing. And I think I'd flip it between those two kind of general scenes, really.
For me, I think it was interesting that last week we covered Face Off, and this week again we get Face Off with a Morton Joe's death, which is kind of gross, but also kind of like the perfect way for that arsehole to go. Mm-hmm. But with Furiosa attaching something off of his face mask onto like a wheel, and just rips his face off, which is,
yeah, that
beautiful.
Is horrible.
I just wanted to make a little pun there. Me personally, my favorite moment in the film is with Nicholas Holt's character. I can't think of what his character is called.
Nux, N-U-X.
Nux. So obviously he has a bit of a kind of, he does a 360 almost, in that he's, at first, he's almost brainwashed by Morton Joe. He's all about trying to get Max and Furiosa, and then he kind of meets the women that Furiosa is trying to protect, and he almost realizes that what he's doing is wrong, and he gets a connection, develops a connection with one of the women in particular, and I think he probably almost like is. Falls in love with her beauty almost, because he's never really had like any sort of intimacy as such, because you see her kind of just giving him a hug, trying to kind of and make him feel human. And throughout the film you have the what are they called again, all
the war boys,
yeah. God, that
the halflings,
yeah. Yes, the halflings, the war boys. Throughout the film, you get them shouting, "Witness me!" before they sacrifice themselves, and it's almost meaningless because you know that it's just their minds are warped. They've been radicalized. So saying "Witness me" is almost meaningless to us. But then, before Nicholas Holt dies, before his character dies, he looks at the woman that he's kind of just fallen for, and he says, "Witness me," and he doesn't shout it like a lunatic, and it's finally like that phrase gets meaning, you know, it's meaningful. And I think there are little bits like that kind of do bring a lot more to this film than just action. And I think it's interesting as well that, like, as the film goes on with Nux, it's Nux, isn't it, he kind of becomes, his skin tone becomes more human, like fleshy colored, rather than like the white paint, like the white paint that they seem to be covered in, or if that's their skin before they have like a blood transfusion. I'm not too sure really, but yeah, it's quite interesting to me that he's almost like becoming more human as the film goes on. And yeah, that's just something I really liked about the film, something subtle but something quite meaningful nonetheless.
Yeah, I really like that. I really like the tree moment I talked about, because that is kind of all tension in filmmaking, and are they going to get out in time, are they not, and you see the tree starting to fall over, and that's kind of the tension being strung along more. But I love the ending. Me, the ending kind of reminds me of, you know, the bit in one of the Star Wars movies where they all get the medals and everyone's happy.
Yeah.
It's kind of like that. They release the water, everyone's being ascended up, the visual metaphor in that, and then you see the kind of shot, reverse shot of Furiosa and Max, and he kind of fades back into the crowd. And that sets up, well, what is he looking for now? Is he always going to be a drifter? Is there going to be a sequel? Which I want to quickly touch on, because I did not know this was happening. And Liam, you brought it to our attention. What's going on there, man? Talk to me.
Yeah, so I am the bringer of news that, to be fair, a lot of people already know this, obviously, but there isn't. Yeah, despite the clamor for it, there isn't going to be a sequel. There's going to be a prequel, and it's going to be called Furiosa, and it's going to be basically almost an origin story with Anya Taylor-Joy, who is brilliant, playing Furiosa. I don't know. I was thinking about this before. Is it just going to be like pointless, and then by the end, it's just going to be like, oh, we learned how she lost her arm. Like, it's like, is it going to be one of those? Mm-hmm. Chris Hemsworth is also in it, which is fine, I guess. He's good in action, isn't he? So yeah, we'll see. George Miller's back on board, so I guess there is potential for it to be just as good as Mad Max. But I think we all wanted the story to maybe progress and see where it went, because I think in terms of like the world building, surely we're all intrigued to see the rest of this world.
Mm-hmm.
Like, mm-hmm. Surely we are. You know, what is it about? Just at the beginning of the third act, when they meet the elderly women, I can't think of like the group's name, but they're unaware of Immortan Joe. So as they're trying to find this place of sanctuary almost, and where there's like, you know, vegetation and what have you, and they meet these women, and yeah, they don't know who he is. So obviously it's not just Immortan Joe rules all and everyone mm-hmm. bows down to him. There is obviously different aspects of this world that I think could easily be explored. I think surely for me would be easier to explore if I was George Miller. There's way more you could do. Mm-hmm. I think by doing a prequel, you restrict yourself. But hey, I'm not, you know, an Oscar-winning filmmaker, so, you know.
Just on that, so I was Googling before, and then when you said it's much clamoured for, sorry, a sequel will be much clamoured for, so there is actually a sequel in the works called The Wasteland. Yeah, I just Googled it, because I Googled George Miller to investigate this Happy Feet situation.
It's something we 100% could have done before we started recording. I love that we're doing live news on the
absolute admin. But because I read a piece which was updated late last year that stated there's three Mad Max films in the works, which kind of disappoints me a little bit, because I like, you know, I mean, obviously give them a chance to prove that they maybe can do something as inventive and creative as this, but I really like the idea that, I don't know, not that this is a one-off, but I don't know, it feels more meaningful, doesn't it? Maybe, you know, if it's a one-off, but yeah, there's three in the works, apparently, including the prequel.
I'd not to completely disagree with you, but I'm pretty sure that Wasteland was meant to be, that was meant to be his next film, and he just decided not to do sequels, and he's going to do this one prequel. Because
either way, it's going to be a bit of a... Either way, I don't know how I feel about it. I'm middle ground, you know what I mean? I like that talked about it being a one and done. IP never dies.
I would rather three sequels than one prequel, to be fair.
Yeah, same. I like the way we're dealing with that, yeah.
Man, honestly, it's one of those that I think this film will have a legacy always, and I really hope the prequels or sequels or... let's invent a new term, whatever comes out and doesn't really tarnish that, because for me, it's one of the great modern cinema masterpieces anyway. So any other business points? Is there anything else you want to bring up, talk about, anything else that jumps out to you?
No. I think we've covered we've covered off quite a decent chunk.
I feel like we did. Yeah. I wrote a few witty things down that I didn't get to say, but you know.
Oh man, message me them next time and I'll set you up better. And then it'll be like an alley-oop.
It's okay, never mind. You know, we'll get that soon. Okay. Yeah.
The only one thing I want to bring up is that I don't really like the flashbacks. I'm sorry. I know they're meant to flashback the character. I don't really need them. It's a 2-hour film.
I don't think they do flesh out enough.
Exactly.
If you're going to do these flashbacks, at least elaborate near the end. I think near the end, you needed an extended flashback to understand what the fuck they mean.
Yeah.
Because.
And even without that, it still works. So just cut them out in my book. Yeah. Make it a 1-hour 58 film instead of a 2-hour.
Maybe the editor got to the point where she was like, yeah, we should edit this out, but fuck me, I've been doing 100 hours. Let's leave them in.
Yeah.
I think that's it. Okay, we'll just go on to popcorns then because I have a feeling it's going to be quite high scoring, but we'll find out. Look, it was your first take. I want to know, what did you give it?
79, which... I think feels not that great. And I think I always think about this as in Football Manager scores and go, like, if I had a striker who was 79, I'm not sure I'd be too keen on him. But or FIFA maybe. But no, yeah, 79 just because of like the visuals are absolutely excellent. The story was good, and I do think that I'd jump up possibly by about 10 if I watched it kind of again. But yeah, 79.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think in terms of like FIFA scores. You never get 100. The best players only ever get on like Ultimate Team, only ever get 99. You never get 100. So with that in mind, no, I'm going to give it 90 popcorns. But believe me, if I was rating this film after my first watch, it would not be 90 popcorns. But definitely, I've watched it 4 or 5 times now. So 90 is fair in my opinion.
I honestly echo everything you just said there because first watch, like I said, it felt a bit exhausting to me. But now after probably 6, 7, 8, 9, 12 watches, it's a 90. It's a real landmark milestone in action cinema, and it's going to be up there with the likes of The Raid, and I'm going to put John Wick up there too as modern action cinema. Masterpieces. Don't quote me on that. Anyway, let's talk about next week because next week we're having our second ever guest on. It's something we kind of talked about when we were thinking about coming back, that we wanted to start getting guests on maybe once a month. And we wanted to get people on that were kind of in the same little circles we were and hopefully promote them and give light to what they do. So next week we're going to have Danielle from Your Gals on Film. And Luke, do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I'm quite excited to have kind of people on. Like one of my highlights of my week is just like talking to you guys and obviously just like messaging you guys and seeing you guys when we're in person. But I think it's going to be quite interesting, especially as we kind of go into like another year of the pod, kind of spicing it up a little bit and injecting a little bit of difference in there and maybe even films that like we've all seen but someone else hasn't. And that's kind of where we're going to next week with Danielle, who is like a friend of the pod, and we've done different bits with her, and we worked on the Liverpool Film Festival with her, like with her blog, which is really good, and with Explore Liverpool. So we are going to be looking at the film Jaws, which, like, to me, as a film to come in, and, you know, considering we're trying to think, well, maybe we can get some biggies in there. That's kind of like as big as it gets. So she's never seen that. She like gave us a couple of options, which I didn't pass on to you because as soon as she said Jaws, I was like, "Are you joking?
Jaws, cool.
Got to be Jaws.
It has to be Jaws."
So we're gonna do that. We're really excited, and we're gonna like try and get, you know, a guest on every month, and make that quite a thing that we do. So yeah, that's what we're gonna do next week.
Awesome. I'm really looking forward to that. And I'm also really looking forward to finding some guests who haven't watched any Paul Thomas Anderson films so we can talk about him again. Okay, so until next week, guys, and until we talk about Jaws, I've been Connor, and I'll see you later.